I am on my Michael Mann tip, dude. I am now fascinated with Miami Vice. Have you seen Miami Vice? It's a terrible movie.
Absolutely not.
When did you run into Jamie Foxx? What year did you have your now famous altercation?
I would say 5 years ago.
Oh, 5 years ago. So
4 years ago?
Miami Vice.
Right? 3 years ago?
Miami Vice was sort of, Jamie Foxx was like pressuring Michael Mann, hey, we got to do Miami Vice. We have to. Jamie Foxx worked with him on Ali. He worked with him on Collateral. And he finally gets Michael Mann to, okay. Michael Mann always kind of thought it was cheesy, wasn't the right time, even though he created Miami Vice. Jamie Foxx finally gets him to do Miami Vice. They sign Colin Farrell, who at the time is like the biggest star in the world. But from the time that Jamie Foxx agrees to do Miami Vice to the time it actually enters production, Jamie Foxx wins an Oscar, drops an album, and becomes arguably one of the biggest Hollywood celebrities. And he was making almost half as much as Colin Farrell was. He demands like top billing, first on the poster. They even change the posters. And Colin Farrell's just like, yeah, take it out of my salary. I don't care. And then Jamie Foxx, who was so adamant to make Miami Vice, who was like, and Miami Vice, what do you think about Miami Vice? You know, fast boats, fast cars, great action movie. Jamie Foxx is like, I'm not hopping in any vehicles. So Jamie Foxx is like barely in this movie. Also because he leaves shooting because Michael Mann insists on filming in lawless places. And where like Hezbollah arms deals go down. And there's like people dying, getting shot. And Jamie Foxx is like, I'm out. And he renegotiates his deal time in and time out. So a fascinating watch. David Sampson, a more fascinating story behind the making of Miami Vice.
Okay, I guess that means I have to watch it.
You have to watch it because I'm going to watch it. I've been listening to podcasts about Miami Vice, and now I have to actually watch this crap movie. Crap movie. Speaking of movies, David Sampson, as I bored you and the audience, I feel, with my passionate takes about Miami Vice, I want to talk to you about something we touched on the national show, and welcome in Dan here. I know he has thoughts. HBO Max is changing cinema with their decision to release massive tentpole films via HBO Max. There will also be limited theatrical releases, but we're talking massive, massive films. We're talking Dune, The Matrix 4, Wonder Woman 84. So there is huge, huge unrest inside the movie theater industry right now. Once you get the toothpaste out of the bottle, it's very hard to put it back in. Your thoughts on what Warner Brothers is deciding to do with HBO Max?
And have you ever had toothpaste in a bottle? Is that something you've ever seen in your life? Bottled toothpaste?
Yeah, I normally would say tube but now I actually buy in bulk the ones that are easy to dispense, because I find tubes of toothpaste are extremely messy because you can't properly roll them from the bottom. And so you end up squeezing from the top all the time, and then you leave a bunch of toothpaste in the bottom. Then you have to squeeze up and you try to roll it. It comes unrolled. So I don't use them anymore. But you're damn right. We use that expression a lot in baseball, actually. Once you open the bottle, you can't get the toothpaste back in.
Okay.
What do you make of the movie industry, though?
Okay.
The changes
Here's the deal.
In the movie industry.
It is the most obvious business decision of all time. Here's where the world has changed with COVID. And it's an example where it will be a change that will not stop once there are widespread vaccines. And once the world gets back to whatever the new normal may be, what I believe COVID has done, it has accelerated certain changes that were going to happen anyway. As an example, in sports, the changing in the minor league system in baseball, that was going to happen. It's been talked about for a decade, maybe more. COVID was the cover under which big businesses can make big decisions that will be very largely beneficial to them over the next decade. This movie theater change is the same exact thing. Movie theaters are an industry that was lacking, right? No one wants to go to an iPix theater and sit in a couch that someone else was just sitting in and get served food that is really just movie theater food, double the price. When you're home now with high definition TVs, it is easier to watch bigger movies. Everyone's got a better opportunity to do so. All Warner Brothers did was acknowledge the fact that they've got to find a way to make money. Look at what happened with Disney and Mulan. They got their ass kicked and they thought they could do a $39.99 and get people. I did it because I'm crazy, but Mulan was a nightmare and they've pushed back their releases during this pandemic. So there's a logjam. So actors ought to be celebrating the fact that they're going to Warner Brothers cut this deal and that there's a way to do a distribution to streaming services. Because what will happen is over time, guys, is the money for the actors will end up being the same. But there's this interim period where there is that concern. And that's why you get some directors like Christopher Nolan or some actors saying, whoa, my back end's in jeopardy. But no, their back end is in jeopardy if the change hadn't been made.
But I've read that this isn't exactly a sustainable business model for the studios either. The studios need the theater industry. The worldwide box office is still massively bankable. At least it was pre-pandemic. Now, things can certainly change as behaviors have changed. But for movie studios to put the kind of budgets into these films and for them to not get a proper theatrical release, maybe that's fine for year one as you're trying to establish HBO Max as this brand. But there's no way you can have these big budget traditional box office movies if they're going on a streaming platform.
Well, you said worldwide box office. Keep in mind the deal that Warner Brothers is doing is for the United States only. So there are these movies will still be released in theaters around the world. So they will be capturing international movie theater income. But also keep in mind that in the old days, when a movie went straight to video, we'd say, wow, that must be a crappy movie. It went straight to video. Those days are over. You've got quality things coming out and that are going straight to video now. And it's worked. So I'm not sure I understand the economic argument you're making. The theaters are going to be hurting the theater companies. That's not the studios. You're talking about Cinemark and AMC and people who make money by having people walk into a theater. Those companies have a problem, but not the studios and not the actors. These movies will be profitable again.
I'm a boomer by saying I like going to the movie theater because it's something that the younger generation doesn't do. I was listening to, again, this podcast on Miami Vice, the making of Miami Vice. It's called Blank Check. And they actually had to take at the beginning that this generation goes to a movie, where my generation goes to the movies. You go with a group of friends, you find out an agreeable movie, and you end up watching You, Me, and Dupree and whatever. It was, you have laughs. But now you go to see Spider-Man Far From Home. Like, you have these event pictures, and without like videotape sales to lean on, where movies like Heat have this great afterlife after a disappointing box office release, I actually think we're going to see fewer chances taken by movie studios. David, I'm really worried about this industry right now.
But Mikey, that's what we've been seeing for a decade with all these sequels. There are very few really good quality movies because what happens is they've gone to the lowest common denominator. And so that's how you get Fast and the Furious Part 12. And that's how you get all of the Avenger movies. Those are the movies that pay the bills. And then once in a while, they'll let the Incredible Hulk make a movie like Dark Waters, a movie that matters. But frankly, those types of movies are they're becoming relics. And that's disappointing. I watched one of those types of movies. I'm not reviewing it here today. I'm going to do it on Nothing Personal. But there are still good movies coming out. But it's okay to say it came out on Amazon. And that's where you're seeing it. And that is, and the money is coming through subscriptions. So you also say HBO Max, they paid Warner Brothers, just so we're clear on how that works. So the studio got money for this deal. This was not Warner Brothers trying to prop up HBO Max.
I'm sorry, isn't that a diverting of funds though, because the same parent company?
It's different. That's like saying that you want, it's silos in a company. Think about the company you're currently working for. You think there are enough silos at Disney right now that they focus on certain silos and ignore others? Any thoughts on that?
Nope.
I've got thoughts on that. Perhaps I'll share them in a different podcast. The way you just said that you're basically embargoing your movie critique for your podcast. I'm going to suss it out right here. I'm not going to let you get the audience go over there because they want to find out what your movie review is on an Amazon movie on Nothing Personal. I want it right here, right now. I want our audience to get the exclusive look and your audience to get the dirty leftovers.
Do you know how hard it must be for you during these last few weeks to keep not getting what you want? I'm so sorry, Dan.
What are you talking about? I'm getting everything that I want at every turn. Are you going to deny me everything I want? You're going to be the one. I was reading this article about Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp, they say for 35 years, no one told him no. And so he actually had a bodyguard whose job it was to wipe the drugs off his face. And he had an earpiece. It was reported he had an earpiece so he didn't have to remember his lines. Just somebody reading his lines because no one said no to him for 35 years. And I'm reading the article and I'm like, that's me. That's me. No one said no to me for 35 years. You're going to deny me this damn critique of a movie on Amazon Prime? I'll destroy you. I will with vengeance come searching for you, and I will find that critique and I will urinate on it. I will make sure that you don't have democratic rights in this country to give your opinion on movies.
I'm sorry, I was on the other phone. What were you saying?
We like your movie expertise around here and your sports expertise, but your business expertise is something that we don't know anything about because we are woefully deficient in this area and you are very strong in this area. Do you understand what happened with Under Armour? My brother is friends with the CEOs or the former CEOs of that company. They're partying brothers, and Under Armour had like a $10 million buyout with Cincinnati. They had to terminate a deal with Cal that had $58 million left on it. They had that big UCLA deal that was $280 million. They were trying to get into the Nike game, and now all of a sudden they've left all the pieces. Nike's getting those schools pennies on the dollar because Under Armour has failed and flailed. What did you make of everything happening there?
You didn't even mention the MLB deal. Under Armour had a deal to be the jersey supplier for MLB, and there was going to be an Under Armour logo on the jerseys, and they couldn't even perform on the deal. It didn't even get to start before it went back to Nike. So what happened with Under Armour is pretty simple, is they thought that this happens in many businesses, right? When you expand too quickly and you don't have the concomitant revenue to cover the expenses that you use to expand, you're pretty much out of business. And that's what happened to Under Armour.
Well, what can you tell
us? It's actually simple, Dan.
But what can you tell us about where and how they failed? Because they saw an opening. And frankly, they saw an opening before others did because they tried to get into the game. They saw the Amazon play. They saw the online play, but they weren't able to execute it. They spent all this money, and they weren't able to get into the high end of the game because they weren't able to execute their business plan.
But the business, so here's what happens. When you just think about any business, let's say you own a corner bookstore and you want to expand. So you buy another corner bookstore and then another, then you go to another city, then you go to another state. All of a sudden you've got, you can say on your, that I've got 30 stores that I own, but yet you don't have the right employees to run the stores. You can't get the books to put in the stores. Therefore, you're not selling the books. Therefore, you can't make the rent. Therefore, you have to shut the stores down before they even get going. That's all Under Armour did. Picture the stores as these schools. They kept going to schools and saying, hey, we're gonna be your supplier. We will pay you. All it is a sponsorship deal. When you come right down to it, what Under Armour was doing was paying schools to supply them with uniforms. And the uniforms would bear their logo, and they thought that that sort of PR and that sort of marketing would lead to increases in their shoe line, would lead to increases in their clothing line, and none of that happened. They went to these athletes and said, we're going to pay you, wear Under Armour stuff, thinking that if they wear Under Armour sneakers, they'll be in the sneaker game. None of the things happened that they actually thought would happen. There's been tremendous turnover there in Baltimore, tremendous from every level of the organization. Go back. Do you remember the shoe company And One?
Yeah.
Remember that company back in the day?
Yeah.
That was started by two high school classmates of mine. And when they signed their first big player, remember what a big deal it was?
Yeah, Steph Marbury, right?
Stephon Marbury. And the thought was that by giving him all that money and having Marbury wear And One shoes, that's it. They're going to be Nike. What people don't realize is Nike wasn't Nike until it was Nike. And when Nike, it's very hard to try to become Nike without having a boatload of cash in order to prop you up. And One and Under Armour just didn't have that.
I will say, just from a consumer perspective, as Dan has all these stats and figures and you're bringing the business acumen, the shoes weren't cool. The shoes were laughed at. And you can't be laughed at. Like, they signed Steph Curry. They were in the game for Kevin Durant. And there wasn't a single shoe that they put out in the market that wasn't just critically panned. And now Steph Curry is even separating himself, even though he's an Under Armour athlete. They've just carved out his own brand just because putting that logo on shoes is a death sentence at this point.
But so you just answered your question, didn't you? That's how you pay for all of these deals you do. So what happens is you meet with your lieutenants if you're the owner of or you run Under Armour, and you look and you say, okay, here's all of our expenses, and you bring out the list like Jim Carrey, and you have a huge list up and down of different schools that you owe money to and for how many years. And then you go to your revenue side and say, we projected Steph Curry to bring in $1 billion of revenue. Holy crap, it's only $100 million. That's a $900 million mistake. What are we going to cut on the expense side? So they go to the schools and say, hey, listen, we changed our mind. We don't want to be in a uniform. They go to MLB and say, we can't perform. We change our mind. Go sell it somewhere else. And that's how you bring your expenses down.
Under Armour owned, they owe Cal $58 million cash, or on the deal, $58 million cash. That's Cal. So explain to me how it is that you break these contracts. Explain to me what experience you have with buyouts and with negotiated. Like, what do you, when you're doing buyouts, take us through like the most contentious one or the most memorable one that you've had to deal with.
Well, it comes down to cash, right? So what you go to the other side is you say, listen, on this day, we owe you $20 million as an installment payment because we pay you $100 million a year for the rights to uniform you. We owe you $20 million on October 1st. We don't have it. So I would go, I would call the company, and I would call the president, and I would say, we are going to miss that payment. Here's the four things we can do. One, we can defer that payment into next year on the hope that things get better. Two, we can renegotiate our current deal and add another year onto it and make the annual money that we give you smaller. Or three, we can just terminate the deal. And under termination, you can terminate by just walking away from a contract, and then you are in violation of the contract. And what I would say to someone is, I'm going to terminate you, your contract. You can come after me. Good luck. Good luck, Cal, getting $58 million, because there's no chance. You can't get $58 million when we don't have $58 million. You are going to be online with so many other creditors. And by the way, we purposefully did that because we knew we were expanding so quickly that you didn't notice in the contract that if there a nuclear scenario happens and we end up being pseudo-bankrupt and not being able to pay, you are way down the list. That's what we would tell players, by the way. When players sign contracts, guaranteed contracts, do you know how a team can get out of that? By declaring bankruptcy. Because they are so low on the list of creditors, players are with their guaranteed money, that they would not get paid at all. Now, they'd be out from under the contract and get to re-sign, but there is no guarantee they would replace that money equally. So it's not a difficult concept when you don't want to pay someone. You simply don't pay and you find a way to declare a sort of bankruptcy, and that's it. See you later.
Can you tell us the one detail that people do not know about the negotiations with Giancarlo Stanton? I know that you covered much of this with Mike Ryan, but is there anything that you remember about the specifics of his distrust toward you guys and how everyone in our audience was sort of skeptical? What are the Marlins doing? They never do this. They just gave the richest contract in sports. They gave it with a no trade clause. Like, what was the thing about that? Because I imagine he didn't trust you guys to come through on the giving of that money.
No, it actually had nothing to do with the giving of the money. What he didn't trust is that we'd have enough money left over to build a competitive team around him. So his biggest issue was, if you're paying me $30 million in 2020, as an example, or 2021, how big is your payroll going to be? And what we said to him at the time is, in order to win, our view is you have to be no more than 20 to 25% of the total team payroll. And that's a number that we made up because in 2003, Pudge Rodriguez made $10 million. Our total payroll was 40. So we had him as basically 25%, and we managed to win a World Series. So we said to him, if we can have a payroll of 120 by the time 2020 comes, we're going to be able to be competitive and you're going to be fine. And Giancarlo didn't believe that we would ever get to a payroll of 120 because he didn't think the revenues were significant enough in Miami to get to that number. And my view was, it was 6 years down the road and I'm going to worry about it then. And if we can't get a team together around him, then we'll find a way to move him because he claims he wants to win. And that's where his weakness was. He said to me, all I want to do is win. And so I need to make sure that there's enough money left over to win. But then I said, Giancarlo, come on, man. What number can we offer you where you're not going to say no? Just tell me. And so he said, it's going to have to be 325 over 13. And I said, we'll do that, but it's going to have to be done in a way that these first 6 years from now until 2020 is a total underpay. And then we'll backload the contract and we'll worry about it then. And then he said, okay, but you're going to have to give me an opt-out after those 6 years. And I said, no problem, because your average annual value once your opt-out comes is $30 million a year. And if you're worth more, go get it. And if you're worth less, our fault, but we got 6 years of you where we paid you less than what you were worth. And that's how deals get done, when two sides believe that they're both getting something. And that's what happened in the Stanton deal.
All right, everybody, I'm warning you. I've been on my best behavior when it comes to Miami Hurricanes football this season.
You have?
I haven't. I've barely talked about them. They're a top 10 team. They're 9-1. I'm very excited about this team. But as I was lining up this question about whether or not the juice has been worth the squeeze, because I'm getting legitimately upset at what college football is doing, and this is strictly as like a University of Miami fan, forget the fact that one of my players has myocarditis right now and how unhealthy this is and the fact that they don't play them. But it seems as though this was a pointless exercise. These are just made for TV events and they're mitigating losses. When you have teams that are playing half as many games as a one-loss Miami team, that just seems like preseason, we're writing them in no matter what. We'll gain the rankings, so we make a 4-win, a 4-0 USC have just as much of a chance at a college football playoff as a 9-1 Miami Hurricanes. It feels like bullshit, David. Tell me about it.
They've always been gaming the system for this season. You guys are so funny to me, because every time you hear something that is so logical economically, but it goes against your emotional state, you have this incredulous sound in your voice that I love the naivete. Are you just saying that you can't believe that college football and the NCAA did something with money in mind?
You are really no. What we're saying, and I don't need your condescension from on high, Mr. Sampson.
Maybe some people in the audience are happy.
That is merely me saying that you sound emotional.
No, you get preyed upon.
You get preyed upon by the NCAA because of you, Mike. Exactly the way you are is why the NCAA does what it does.
You are a shark made of water. Of wires who sort of moves through these business waters coldly and will not accept the emotional mythology that comes with this business. You're in the emotions business. Your Nothing Personal podcast is named Nothing Personal, at least in part because you know that you're the thing in the emotion business that is sans emotion. But you profit off it.
So what was the question?
That you are a shark. You're not disputing anything I'm saying there. You are just a cold-hearted business person, and you're always running against being counterculture because you're in a business that's not cold-hearted. It's the opposite of that. When we're talking about Nike got to where it was in terms of cool. That was a marketing move. Because they did such a great job of toying with the mythology. You have ice in your stare when you talk about this stuff. And it's one of the reasons that it's different, because the people listening to this don't understand the business side, which gets me to where it is we were yesterday, where I wanted to talk to you about what you think of sports business reporting. What does David Sampson think simply about sports business journalism? Because you say I'm naive, but I'm telling you it's because the media has not gotten smart enough to cover you guys in a way that makes us smarter about consuming this stuff.
So who would you say is the number one sports business
reporter? Well, this is the thing. It was only Revelle, but the reason it was Revelle is because ESPN didn't want to give an actual tray of 20, 30, 40 business reporters who are investigating their partners. They just took that guy who everyone in business looks at and says, that guy's not qualified to be the best of our business reporters.
So Brian Gumbel, Bob Lee, are any of these guys in your mind business reporters?
No.
The definition to me of a business reporter is someone who's able to explain to his or her audience, his, her, or their audience, that which is going on in terms that they can understand. That's what a business reporter does. That's what all we're trying to do, and I'm trying to do with my audience, is communicate with them and inform them what's going on and then have them make their own decision. I don't need people to agree with my point of view on transactions or on business issues that are taking place. I'm trying to explain it. I'm not asking you to agree with what college football and the NCAA is doing. I'm merely pointing out that of course they're going to allow for a 4-0 team versus an 8-1 team because they get their money. You just dropped a word like mitigating losses as though it's the plague. Mitigating losses is the game everyone's in 2020, and you should know that because it's impacted you guys. And mitigating losses is something that when you run a business, you have to do. From a sports reporting standpoint, Dan, the problem is if you explain to someone something that you think they should understand and then have a certain reaction to, you're not being a good sports reporter. I try to explain to people what's going on and have zero vested interest in whether they want to understand it, whether they want to agree with it or disagree with it. I just want them to have it in their heads so they have three or four talking points and can understand why people in my old position throughout all of sports do what they do. That's my purpose.
Playing 5-6 more games, college football games, in Power 5 conferences is not a small thing. And we're just overriding it. I don't understand. If this is just a money play and we want Ohio State in college football.
By the way. It is just a money play.
Because when Samson
comes after us and says that we're affected by it, Chris Cody, essentially, if you do the math on this, Chris Cody was fired because of college football's losses, because ESPN has such a vested interest in making sure all of these college football games are played.
Well, why wouldn't they expand the college football playoff the way that MLB expanded their playoffs to know that, hey, this is a wacky season, games are going to be canceled, and since this is a transparent money grab anyways, why not expand our biggest money-making college football property, which is the playoffs, because Miami's going to get shut out, and they may very well lose to North Carolina. I don't think Miami is actually that good, but a team like Miami right now is in the ACC 8-1, having played almost twice the amount of games as Ohio State, and Ohio State is just soaring up the rankings, and this is not a small thing.
Mike, this is super smart. They should this year in the pandemic, the way that baseball doesn't change shit ever. Ever. Baseball, they are the most reluctant changer. This is absolutely the year. He's right, David. This is absolutely the year. If they weren't so afraid of the consequences of making the bowls irrelevant and all the ways that they've done it, they would absolutely expand the playoffs this year to just include a bunch of teams, make it a 20-team tournament.
It's the most obvious thing. We're the network that runs it, Dan. Like, we can make the rules. We're canceling games left and right to make sure Notre Dame gets in, no matter the result in the ACC championship. You're going to tune into that. That's going to be a big moneymaker. We'll cancel the game against Wake Forest to make sure Notre Dame gets in that game, and it's still not going to matter.
Why can't they do that? Why can't they? Why can't
David,
they?
Have the answers for me.
Okay, let's go back to start with baseball and end up at college football. How is it MLB expanded their playoffs? Do you remember actually the mechanics of what happened? So the mechanics were that it was a negotiation with a union. The union, which represents the professional players who are paid money to play. So don't compare college football, which still lives under the joke that the players don't actually get paid, where we know they're paid in other ways, but they do not actually have a union. They are not represented. They're not protected by national labor rules. None of that. They are, as they're called in every press release done by a university, student athletes. That's how they're referred to.
Yeah, so they end up doing... I just saw a BYU-Coastal Carolina game that drew 1.4 million viewers on ESPNU come together in 6 days. They can throw together an expanded playoff, and the kids will have zero say in the matter.
Why wouldn't they do that?
So how did MLB then expand their playoffs? They went to the networks, and they said, how much will you pay for this extra inventory? That was the question. Now what is happening is if you go to ESPN or Disney and say, okay, we're going to give you extra bowl games in early January. Any thoughts on what you would pay for that? So they go and they look at what's happening at Disney, and they say, well, I got to tell you, I'm looking at our schedule. I'm looking at our finances. We've got NFL playoffs that'll be happening during January. That's really where our bread is buttered. Probably not going to spend more money to get extra playoff college football games on, because we don't know whether or not they're going to happen because of COVID, and it would screw up all of our scheduling. So the juice is really not worth the squeeze to pay you to do even more right now. Now, if you do it at a time of year where we don't have NFL, or when we have a hole in our programming, let me tell you when that is. So then they go in their programming schedule and they say, you know what? Can you guys do college bowl games sometime in July? That would be amazing, because all we have is a little baseball in July. We could use some college football. Now, you find a way to bring these student athletes on campus. You find a way to get it done. Then we'll talk. That's how those conversations go.
Can you offer us anything in the way of insight into how complicated it was for the NBA and Disney, who are already in a multi-billion dollar partnership, to just say, hey, okay, we need a bubble. It's going to cost $150 million. Who's going to pick up the cost on this? It's going to be super expensive, and it's going to be one of the minor expenses because everything here is going to be super expensive. And that negotiation, whatever light you could shed on it, what can you also tell us about the fact that basketball went out of its way yesterday? There was a report to give all of its teams a $30 million bump on plus $30 million plus on getting all of its teams money. I have not seen something like that before. Have you? That specifically.
You're saying the NBA did a distribution of $30 million
to each team. To each team, they said, we've got $30 million for you because we've got all these losses we're trying to compensate for.
Yeah, that happens all the time. So MLB, what they would do is they would do a, when you get money from, let's say, Disney into MLB, MLB centrally in New York, if they get $1 billion given to them by Disney, they may give $500 million to all 30 teams total, and they keep $500 million in a segregated account within Central Baseball. So while it seems as though the teams have $1 billion divided by 30, the teams actually only have $500 million. But then you save it for a rainy day. This is the John Cusack, Daphne Zuniga, the sure thing rainy day. This is when you start distributing all the money that you've secreted away in the commissioner's office. You give it to the teams to help them defray all of the losses they've had. So it makes perfect sense that you would take $1 billion if you're MLB, if you're NBA, and you distribute it to all the teams. It's the reason why MLB and other leagues are going to look to expand as soon as they can, because any sort of influx of money right now will help cover the significant losses that all the teams have had over the years. But you asked about Disney, Dan. That's an easy one. If Disney has a multi-billion dollar investment in the NBA, they need games on the air Christmas Day. So what do we have to do to help you? What do we have to do to get the NBA finals on ABC? Well, to do that, we're going to need a bubble, it looks like. All right, we have a perfect place in Orlando. Let's negotiate. What do we need? We need chefs. We need hotel rooms. What's the rate of the hotel rooms? You go, you have a line item of 200 things that need to be negotiated. Disney is saying to itself, we better make this work because we need games on ABC and our parks are closed. Our hotels are empty. Imagine what we can do by getting some amount of profit from our hotels and from the Disney properties during the time when it's closed. The NBA is saying, this is perfect. We need to get paid by Disney to put these games on, and we need a place to stay. It was like a match made in heaven. People who thought the bubble would be in a different place were crazy. Of course it was going to be in Disney.
Do you know the most amount of money? Did you have access to the information that was stashed away by baseball in this fund for a rainy day? And do you know of that amount of money, how it's used? Does it just sit in an account? Is it invested? What's done with that money? That money's so much money that it's got to be something that is making money, correct?
It's an investment account. It's like an endowment, if you want to put it into simple terms. It's like a university endowment where it's money that you try not to touch. You try to use the interest from to do something to be helpful. So for example, when you're trying to help prop up the Dominican Republic, or you want to help prop up your international league, or invest in India, you go from that pot of money. And it actually is an investment. There's an investment committee in Major League Baseball that is in charge of investing that money. And of course, the returns have struggled recently because returns are down in the market, et cetera. But when the returns are going well, you've got a lot of extra money to play
with. But how much? Like, what's the most? Do you know? What's the most? Do they tell you that?
So do you remember there's something called Baseball Expos LP? I don't know if you ever heard of that, but way back, this all started with us back in 2002 when we became the Florida Marlins, when we sold the team to baseball. And then baseball sold the team to the Nationals,
Warner, no?
The Nationals. Lerner, the Lerner family, Mark Lerner and his father, Ted Lerner. Oh, yeah, yeah. When Ted Lerner bought the Nationals from baseball, baseball had this pot of money, and that money went into an account. It was not distributed, and that's what formed and started what was called Baseball Expos, right? LP, BELP is what it was called, the BELP Fund.
Terrible name, BELP.
Yeah, who cares? It's got money.
It's a terrible name, though. BELP. I would never trust anyone who was distributing money from BELP.
I guess that's why you're in a studio that's 4x3 right now.
If only I had signed and partnered with Belp instead of Disney.
And the walls are closing in, David.
Yes, indeed. Right? Do you feel like the guy in the movie who's like Tom Hanks in Joe versus the Volcano?
It's a trash compactor scene from Star Wars right now building.
One of the things that Brockmire did in one of the podcasts that we did with him is to make the joke that Disney was shrinking everything around us so that we would fit in a TikTok. Everything we have would fit in a TikTok.
That's it.
David, I wanted to ask you about the Tampa Bay Rays. Now, you obviously won the World Series in 2003, but you can make the argument that year in, year out, the success of the Tampa Bay Rays on the baseball field is something that you aspired to. That's exactly what you wanted. Get your fans invested on year in, year out. We're going to be in this playoff chase despite the low payroll. However, they're failing once again where you succeeded. You won the World Series, unlike them, and you got a ballpark. This ownership, at every turn, gets a door closed on them. You feel like they're close on Ybor City, gets closed on them. Then the owner comes out and says, we're going to play half portion of the season in Montreal, of all places, in Tampa Bay, to maybe squeeze Tampa Bay. What do you make of what the ownership group is doing there? Are they just doomed to play in that horrible stadium for the rest of their days?
Well, no, the lease runs out after 2027. So they'll be done at Tropicana Field. And here's the play. And it's sort of a secretive play, but it's been the play for a decade. Stu Sternberg never wanted to get dirty, and no one who worked for him did either. And I spent hours talking to them about what it is to get a ballpark done and how to do it. And they were always reticent because they said, wow, people don't like you there. The public doesn't like you. People look at you and they're not going to buy tickets because of you. And I would always say, who cares? There'll be a ballpark, which will increase the value of your team, the asset value, and you'll have a place to play, because how do you know the grass is greener in Charlotte or in Montreal or in Monterey or in Mexico City or in Nashville, San Antonio, Portland, Vegas, yada, 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 yada. How do you know the grass is greener there? And he just never had a willingness to ever have anyone not like him.
Well, what's more common, your philosophy or his, when you're running through business executives and it gets to be, because I have found no matter where it is that you arrive in success, it's all high school. All of it is relationships that remind you of high school. And there were dudes in high school who had the confidence to not be liked. And there were people in high school who all they wanted to do was be liked. So which is the one that you ran into more often? What you are, which is not giving one bleep whether you're liked or not, or what Tampa is?
It's way more common to be what Tampa is, because if you go back, it feels better, right? If you actually care how it feels way better to be liked than not to be liked. Listen, it's exhausting for me to have to answer all of the people on Twitter and all the people I meet during the course of a day. And it still happens to me where I still have to meet people and they say, wow, you're not at all what I thought you were. And I still have to do it. It's like blocking and tackling one listener at a time to get the reaction of, wow, you're not anywhere near what you used to be. But if you're going to do a deal like a ballpark deal and take public money for it, listen, you can be liked and build a stadium, but you have to pay for it yourself. But in Tampa, the economics of that do not make sense. That was never going to happen. And then you've got Tampa saying to itself, I don't know if I want to stay in Tampa at all. I want to move the team, but baseball is not going to let me move until I exhaust all possibilities of getting a park done in Tampa. So I'm going to pretend to do a deal in Ybor City. I'm going to pretend that I'm meeting with mayors and meeting with the governor and trying to figure out a way to get it done. Meanwhile, TikTok, we're making money every year. We're smarter than the Marlins and every other team, because while I'm waiting for a new stadium, we're still winning. We're still making money. We haven't won a World Series, but we're damn competitive. Everyone's jealous of us. So I'm just going to let the time pass. The ultimate end to procrastination is when a decision has to be made because there's no more time to procrastinate. That's by definition. So in 2027, when the lease runs out at Tropicana Field, they'll move because they'll either get a ballpark and that deadline is 2024 to start building so it can be ready, or they're just going to relocate. A ballpark will have to be starting to get built somewhere. Here's why. Under the rules of baseball, little known fact, when you sign on to buy a team, you become a franchise of Major League Baseball. One of the requirements to maintain your franchise is you have to have a major league facility to play in. If not, baseball can take away your franchise, which is why I used to carry around in my black bag the note from Wayne Huizenga and the follow-up note from Steve Ross that said, look, we will not extend your deal with us at Pro Player Stadium. We won't do it. So I got to go to Bud Selig and say, hey, listen, you have to give us permission to seek relocation because we don't have a place to play. And without a place to play, you have the right to take our franchise. You will lose that litigation if you try to take our franchise away without having given us a chance to relocate. That's when they gave us a chance to relocate. That's when we got the deal done with Miami and everyone lived happily ever after. Well, everyone except Billy Corbin. So that's what's going to happen with Tampa.
I think, and I have not heard that before, the idea that Tampa will likely, it sounds like, move in 27 because baseball teams don't tend to relocate very often.
After 27.
Right.
So starting with 28, right.
But one of the things that you said there is I was asking you the question about being liked and not being liked. I was watching a very good documentary or docuseries on Showtime about the Reagans, and it was fascinating to see Nancy Reagan interviewed. And she was asked if her self-confidence had improved. And her response was, well, yeah, because people like me more now, which is the opposite of self-confidence. Like it's if it's not if you need others to like you, that is not confidence from self. But I am surprised to hear you say that people in business are that caught up in their feelings, because I view the business the best business people I've ever met are steely-eyed about that shit. It ain't about emotions. Dude, I don't care if you like me or not. Did we just make a deal that improves the value of my franchise? That is the only thing that people like you are trying to get to. It ain't about doing what, Mark Cuban did yesterday, where he signed J.J. Barea only to give him $2.6 million and then waived him, like just for a lifetime of service, signed him for 1 year, gave him a $2.6 million gift as a parachute.
Eyewash. Truly. Mark Cuban is one of the great examples of someone who wants to be liked, by the way. He's got this unbelievable need to have his ego, what's the word? Not placated,
stroked.
But when someone... Stoked, exactly. Thank you, Dan. So giving Barea 2.6
million. I said stroked, but stoked also. Yeah, to have your ego stroked. Yes, like you would, stroke a dog.
You could also stoke an ego.
You could. Both work, but yeah. I think the saying is stroke.
I always heard ego stroked.
It could be, but I'm not familiar with strokes. So what happens is
either way, the toothpaste is out of the bottle.
$2.6 million to him. You don't think that was a business deal for Mark Cuban? He measures sort of PR, and the value he puts on it is way greater than many other people do, including me. So he writes a $2.6 million check, and look what happens. You, the Lebatard show, the greatest, biggest sports talk show in the land, is going to talk about him. That is a winning ticket for Mark Cuban.
Let's get to your review that you find that you can actually give our audience as opposed to
I want the other one. I want the one. I want the one. No, I want the one that you're going to give the nothing personal audience. Just give me the name of the movie. We don't need the actual review. Just give us the name.
Sound of Metal.
Okay.
So it's a Metallica documentary or something?
No, not at all. It is going to be an Oscar. See, by the way, I think you think that right now I'm going to give you the review by asking these questions.
What's good about it? What's good about it? What did you like about it? What's so great about it?
By the way, Dan, I love you doing your Brian Gumbel impersonation, but just put the glasses on the end of your nose and see if that can work. Put them right on the end of your
nose. Let's move on.
Have fake papers in front of you. I watched a movie called David Byrne's American Utopia. David Byrne was the former lead singer of the Talking Heads. And I watched a double feature yesterday, long into the night, of David Byrne's American Utopia, followed by the 1984 movie Stop Making Sense. Stop Making Sense was directed by Jonathan Demme. American Utopia was directed by Spike Lee. They are both concert films, but not in the traditional sense of the word. American Utopia is music by David Byrne, written by David Byrne, and they filmed his Broadway play. And I didn't get to see him on Broadway before Broadway shuttered because it didn't occur to me. I never did the research what it was. And I wanted to just bring up that when things are released for your entertainment and you don't know about them and you choose not to do the research, you could be missing gems. And I missed a gem by not seeing him. David Byrne is talented. He has an 11-piece band, quote unquote, all without shoes, all playing interesting instruments. And he wrote this music that really makes you feel good about music. It's not too overwhelming in its political slants, but they do exist for sure. He actually covers a song by Janelle Monáe.
It's pretty strong with its political slants, though. Like, he doesn't avoid that. He's very strong musically. He's very strong critically. And he absolutely dips into a well. There's no confusion about his viewpoints.
There is no confusion about his viewpoint. He dips in. But what I said was, is that it doesn't overwhelm you to the point that you cannot, if you don't agree with him politically, enjoy the movie. And that to me is important, because in this day and age where there's so much partisanship, there are people who will not engage with someone who has a different view than they do. They don't want to hear it. It's all preaching to the choir. No matter what your politics are, if you are a fan of music, you should see American Utopia. You don't have to agree with what he says, but it's not as overwhelming as, let's say, Bruce Springsteen when he gives speeches during his concerts.
Stop Making Sense is, I don't know how widely it's believed, but it's one of the greatest concert films ever made. What is your favorite concert film?
So Stop Making Sense is a great movie, but a concert film to me is a movie that films a concert. So I'd rather, as opposed to Stop Making Sense, which was not filming a concert. American Utopia is a Broadway show, not filming a concert. The greatest film that ever did a concert, I don't have an answer for you. I'd have to look. Because I love the musical documentaries you've had me watch during quarantine, like the Bob Dylans, the Tom Petty's. There's so many great movies now. I can't think of a straight concert film. What
isn't
do you
it
have?
The Last Waltz? Concert. Isn't The Last Waltz sort of considered that?
That's the band, right? That, as I recall, from 30 years ago. Yeah. But that's... Yeah, but that's the same as Stop Making Sense. I didn't view that as a concert film.
Really? This is probably not a concert film. I'm a huge Jack White fan, and the White Stripes are my favorite band. They had a documentary that followed them on, like, I think their mid-2000s tour of Canada under the Great White Northern Lights, and I really appreciated just how weird their dynamic was. That's a good one, and kind of campy, but I really thought it was ambitious. I don't know if you've seen... I don't know if you're a Metallica guy. You don't rub me as a Metallica guy, but they did a movie, a concert film that actually had like an original storyline interweaved through the concert, where like the main character finds his way to the concert through the Never. I thought it was a really cool concept, but I mean, it was a little cheesy.
The Metallica documentary of them in therapy is one of the best music things I have ever seen, where Metallica opened itself up and its mythology up to look at all these creative problems we have. Look at how troubled and strange our relationship dynamics are. I don't remember the name of that movie, but
Is it Some Kind of Monster?
You got to watch this, David. You will appreciate it because it's very strong in terms of how vulnerable those guys were willing to be. I've got two questions before we get you out of here. One,
Some Kind of Monster, by the way.
We were talking about yesterday directors that you will absolutely have to see as soon as they make a movie. I think your list is going to be the same as ours, but if we limited you to five directors for all time, five directors right now, if you prefer, five directors that you have to see no matter what, you trust them to make a good movie.
Christopher Nolan, whatever he puts out, I'm going to see no matter what. In the old days, it would have been Sidney Pollack, who's now passed away. Steven Spielberg has the benefit of every doubt. I will watch whatever he puts out, no matter how crappy or how good. I will watch every Spike Lee movie, no matter what, because I'm interested in how he makes movies. I will watch a Lawrence Kasdan movie, no matter what.
Your list is totally different than ours. We had Coen Brothers, we had Wes Anderson, we had Tarantino, we had Scorsese. Your list is totally different than ours.
Those are all directors who would be on my list as movies I would see also. When you watch a movie every day, there's time. But the ones you said who I absolutely will make sure I don't miss a movie of, it would be those people. But yeah, Scorsese, when he comes out with movies, of course I'm going to watch it. And Tarantino, it's immediate, but I just didn't think of him. You didn't prepare me.
The other question I wanted to ask you, and I don't know how sensitive or secret this is, but you mentioned Broadway plays, and I believe that David Sampson has the greatest connections in the history of New York in terms of being able to get into whatever plays he wants to. So can that be discussed, or is that something that must remain secret? Because I understand if there's a need for secrecy there, because I've never seen someone with your pull on Broadway.
So the way to understand the need for secrecy is when you're not recording a show that millions of people are listening to, right? You'd bring it up before via text or via email or via phone call.
You mentioned Broadway plays. I had a thought. Come on, we're impromptu around here.
What are you, 12? What, every time you have a thought, you just say it? It goes from your brain to your mouth?
It's been very profitable. It's really worked out for me, David.
Well, that's because you get everything you want and no one says no to you.
I'm still disappointed that we haven't found out about, you know, how you feel really. We got a little bit. He likes the movie he's reviewing about metal.
Sound of Metal. Keep going, Dan. It's not going to work. See, I think the people you have in the show may fall prey to your manipulation. And by the way, the whole world thinks, in my world, my whole orbit thinks that you do that anyway to me, that you pull those strings.
That's right.
I love that.
Yes.
As I continue to subtly steal takes from this podcast, I heard about Miami Vice, and I hear your list.
Wait a minute. You're just...
And what? I hear your list.
No Michael Mann?
No. Well, no, it's not Michael Mann, because Michael Mann... I personally love Michael Mann. I'll seek anything he does, but Michael Mann could never exist as a woman. Like, Nancy Myers is notorious for, like, she's difficult to work with. Meanwhile, like, you're going to a lawless part of the world. But Michael Mann, yeah, what a visionary. Let's keep giving him.
I love
like, the person that directed American Psycho. Like, she's doing TV now. What the hell is
it's
that?
It's so good, the idea that Michael Mann can exist, but Michael Woman can't.
That's a whole nother show, isn't it? Are we getting into gender equality?
All we named was male directors. Like, that was a very male, like, there wasn't a woman on there. There was not one woman we named.
I'm covered. Point Break's one of my favorite movies of all time. Shout out Catherine Bigelow.
She's made some good movies. By the way, Sofia Coppola, I will see whatever she directs. Jason Reitman, I'll see whatever he directs. Mm-hmm. So there are some, and by the way, Nancy Myers makes great movies.
She does.
And great movies. I love when it, but is there any funnier scene in Something's Gotta Give where John Krasinski is in the bathroom with John Krasinski, Alec Baldwin, and Meryl Streep when they're in the bathroom getting stoned, the three of them? Did you ever see a movie called It's Complicated?
I venture out to say there are plenty of funnier scenes.
No, when Alec Baldwin says to John Krasinski, would you like a hit? And he says, no. And then he says, oh, okay.
I mean, I saw Will Ferrell once lick white dog poop.
I understand there are a lot of great scenes in Sound of Metal. Can you tell us about any of them?
What's your favorite scene from that?
Like, what is the best of the scenes?
Give
Did you like that
scene.
Movie?
Why isn't Will Ferrell considered one of the best actors around? That bothers me.
It bothers me, too, because comedy is so much harder.
Movies.
Comedy is so much harder than drama.
Mikey, what about his range?
Yes. He doesn't really test like his dramatic chops. I think he should. He should do that more often. But yeah, he's one of the actors of our time when you consider the execution that his roles that he selects demands.
Adam McKay told us that actors are funny because to do that, you have to sort of be funny. Somewhere within you, you have to be someone who has a sense of humor, even if it's not exhibited in public. And Adam McKay famously worked right next to Will Ferrell on all of that stuff. Like, they Funny or Die and all that stuff became popular, at least in part, because Adam McKay saw what he had in an actor as in Will Ferrell.
Stranger Than Fiction is one of my all-time favorite movies. Everything Must Go with Will Ferrell is simply phenomenal. By the way, did you know Adam McKay is doing a movie with Jennifer Lawrence now?
Yes, and Leo DiCaprio and Meryl Streep.
The cast looks unbelievable.
How'd they get that made?
By the way, my only question, because of your relationship, whether it's public or private, with Adam McKay, how is Jennifer Lawrence? Can you just ask that question on my behalf?
Like, in exchange for a review of The Sound of Metal, I will give you direct Hollywood access to somebody who is filming a movie right now with Leo DiCaprio and Meryl Streep, only in exchange for The Sound of Metal, your exclusive thoughts.
Do you want? I'm not interested in Leonardo DiCaprio. I saw him. He was in San Diego for the All-Star Game, MLB All-Star Game in 2016.
Did you fight with him too, like Jamie Foxx? Let's end another podcast with a great story of David Sampson getting into a fist fight with a drunk Leo DiCaprio.
There was no fist fight at all. He was standing on a bridge and he was smoking a non-cigarette cigarette. You know, the things that come like a vape, if you will. And he looked so out of it. And we were walking by with Josh Gad, who was there. He's a big Miami fan, a big Marlins fan. And he was there. And so we sort of
does that top Larry Blue scene as
that
a
is
name
so
drop.
Good. No, but it's so good. Josh Gad as like the Marlins' biggest celebrity endorser is so good.
Not a celebrity endorser of the Marlins. He was a celebrity endorser of mine, and we were having fun at an All-Star game. But you can make any funny story seem like I'm trying to not be, but thank you, Dan. So anyway, walk by Leonardo DiCaprio. We say something to him, and he grunts. He grunted. That was the greeting that we got. It was the most bizarre, and we sort of laughed about it. Like, what was that? Because he was alone. It's not like he had a posse around him. Totally alone, and it would have been perfectly fine to stop and say hello and have a conversation or whatever, and it was a grunt. It was very weird.
Where do you rank people in terms of you most awestruck spending time with somebody? I know Geddy Lee from Rush was in the skybox with you watching a Marlins game. Where else?
Office. We never made it to the office. We never made it out of the office. We were in PJ Loyola's office the entire game watching with Geddy Lee. I was starstruck the first time I interviewed Don Mattingly to be the manager because I had been a Yankee Don Mattingly guy as a kid.
Me too.
And I found that to be strange. Like he's asking us for a job and I want to ask him for an autograph and just talk about baseball. So that ended immediately because it just did. Once he's your manager, no longer can you genuflect in his general direction. But there have been moments. The first time I walked into an owner's meeting and saw George Steinbrenner in an owner's meeting.
That's funny, it's baseball people. I would have assumed it would have been Hollywood people.
No, Hollywood people do not do that to me.
Or entertainment people.
But no, I try to be cool. Like when I met Elvis Costello, I try to be cool. So I don't want to be awestruck. And anytime I'm awestruck, I totally internalize it because I don't want anyone to think I am, because then I think that they'll react differently to me.
There was a random time that we were doing a radio only show and Bryan Cranston just stopped by when Dan and Stu were out. And that was, I'm fine when I can prepare myself for it. But when Bryan Cranston, when you hear a knock at the door and it's Benjamin Bratt and Bryan Cranston, you kind of want to be prepared for that.
Isn't there a
How
famous-
cool was Cranston?
I mean, he was awesome, very but nice. I couldn't stop looking at Benjamin Bratt's face, quite honestly.
I actually thought, and I don't know what I was doing there, that for some reason he showed up with Lou Diamond Phillips, not Benjamin Bratt.
I know what you're doing there.
Is Benjamin Bratt the very angular-faced man, good-looking sort of man with very serious cheekbones and angles? Is that the same actor we're talking about?
Sort of like ethnic, but you're not exactly sure.
Did he make a movie where he could fix people? He was like a fixer. He was like a TV series that are a movie where he was a fixer of stuff.
I mean, he made
underprivileged drug addicts and make them not drug addicts anymore.
I'm not entirely sure, but he was pitch perfect in Demolition Man.
Wesley Snipes? What happened?
I actually read an interesting article on that.
We will get to that next week, maybe. I just love that
where Wesley Snipes is next week.
You with no sense of irony did Bryan Cranston knocking on a door, and I think of his most famous scene as being, I'm the one who knocks.
Join us next week when David Samson reviews The Sound of Metal.
How was that? Was it pretty good?
It's so good.
Yeah. Favorite scene?
Tell me more.
Favorite scene?
See you later. Still
you said it was so good.
Listen to nothing.
That's a partial less.
Hosted by David
Samson. That's a partial yes.
Subscribe,
partial yes.
Rate,
it's
review.
So good. So good.
See you later. Jesus Christ.